Write that down for me, Saito.
Write that down.
Write that. Write that. Right.
With Fumi Saito and Justin Nipper.
Write that. Write that down for me, Saito.
Hi, patrons. Welcome back. I'm Justin Nipper, and this is Write That Down. And I'm here with Fumi Saito. Fumi, hello.
Hello from Tokyo.
Hello from Portland, Oregon. Did you have a long weekend?
Oh, yeah.
You're feeling tired earlier, right?
A little bit tired. And also, we're still in Japan. We're still in a state of emergency. And they don't tell you what, but this state of emergency is a little bit different from last year's state of emergency, and half the people still go to work, and state of emergency, they should stop subways and trains, right? But they are running trains and subways, you know,
like regular on schedule, like until 12 or 1,
a little bit reduced schedule. But you know, you've lived in Tokyo and you've lived in Japan, but you have to get on a train. You have to get on a subway to go anywhere, right?
Hmm. You can't walk 2-3 hours.
Right. But that's like when you spread, you know, it's just like how this COVID thing, you know, spread so widely all over the world. The people move, right?
Hmm.
So if you stay home, you know, that's better. But it's been a pretty weird month, you know. And you pretty much read that. Maybe you read the news that IOC, you know, and JOC, mm-hmm. that the Japan Olympic Committee still think they run Olympic this summer. That's crazy.
I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
Yeah, I think because there's so much money involved. So I don't know.
It's not about athletes. No,
no
way. It's not about peace and harmony and world peace and all these things. It's about like almost money, advertising agency and rights and TV rights and all those things. You know, they think that they're gonna live stream all the events like on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That they're selling the app. What?
That's
just crazy thing, you know. Then also there's a kind of like a. Most people, the statistics shows that the 80% Japanese population don't think, you know, there's going to be an Olympic, you know,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes you can't say, you know, F, you know, fuck the Olympic, right? It's like, oh God, and it's like, everybody knows it's not right to have an Olympic, but they're still talking about it. So it's like, I'm not gonna say anything about it, right? Kind of like that.
I understand. It's different in the States right now. I think Japan and the States are just at different levels, so it's hard to even compare. So I'm curious. So wrestling shows are ending at around 8 p.m. right now. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a kind of curfew for most live events.
All the shows are like just about 2 hours long, you know. And when, do you remember all these Japanese companies, they used to have like 8-9 matches a night, sometimes, more,
mm-hmm.
7-9 matches or so, right? But now they are just giving like 5 or 6 matches, and they want people to get out of the building. Therefore, the whole staff of Korakuen Hall is going to do the cleaning up the whole place.
That's intense. That's intense. They do a good job, though.
Yeah, and then also they came up with a new seating. Okay, imagine Korakuen Hall, you know, the ring, around the ring and the guardrails, and they only give you one row in ringside. And the other places, like every third place, you know, seats are available, you know, and there's an X on it and you can't sit. So it's social distance seating. And you could only have up to like 500 people in at Korakuen. It's like a one third, you know?
Well, it sounds like everybody at least has a lot of leg room. So that's good.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And also there's a rule that the mask, you know, you'll be wearing mask at all time. You won't be standing and cheering and screaming and all that. and you won't be touching anybody, or you won't, you're not going to walk up to the wrestler to touch him or anything, or no high-fiving, no shaking hands, nothing. And yeah, people follow the rule in Japan, I guess.
I've seen a lot of air hugs recently. Tanahashi's
air
in
hugs,
charge.
Yeah, right. Air hugs. Tanahashi's air hug. Yeah. So the language, yeah, it's like a body language hasn't even changed, you know?
And even the no chanting, but clapping, like a rhythm.
A clapping, yeah. But Japanese wrestling audience always clapped. So it was okay, you know?
That's right.
Okay. And also, tonight, you know, today we're talking about Keiji Muto, his 58-year-old Keiji Muto's, possibly his last reign as a major, you know, singles championship, which is known as, you know, Global Honored Crown Championship, GHC, you know. And it was, a lot of people didn't think this pro wrestling known as Budokan card could, you know, happen, but they did it. They did it. And it was success, you know. Pro Wrestling Noah had this Nippon Budokan show for the first time in 11 years. Had to be success, you know? And yeah, I think they did well under the circumstance. And see, if you fill up Budokan, you can hold 16 to 18,000 people for wrestling, you know? But with this social distance thing, you can only have 1/4 or so at the Budokan. And Budokan's, you know, the policy is a little bit more strict. And yeah, but they ran the show and then it was a success. And also, I think it was historical. I mean, years from now, people will be talking about 2021, you know, in February, 58-year-old Keiji Muto joined Pro Wrestling Noah and won the title. That was his final reign. And a couple of days after the title switch, I mean, he won the title, and there was a press conference. You know about this, right? That Keiji Muto officially signed 2-year exclusive contract with Pro Wrestling Noah.
That's right. They announced it after the Noah win on Saturday.
Yeah.
So he'll
be
there for 2 years.
Yeah, exclusive.
So it's not just because at first I didn't know what to expect. And to be honest, I really didn't expect Muto to win after Shiozaki.
Right.
I mean, Shiozaki is kind of a new champion, so it was a shock. But it seems like he'll probably be a big part of Noah going forward, at least for the time being.
And I think it's going to be very important for Go Shiozaki to beat Muto to get the title back. You have to get it back from him.
Oh, he has to do. In the end, it has to be Shiozaki,
you know what I'm saying?
It seems like.
I mean, you can't be other champion. I mean, you have to be Keiji Muto to become real champion, you know? But that will make him very special.
And Kaito Kiyomiya came out to challenge Muto.
Right, another golden boy. Right.
So he seemed like more of a golden boy a year or two ago, but are they... what's going on with his? Because yeah, they're really kind of giving him the
big
Roman Reigns treatment.
Stop and yeah, big push, accelerate, idling, big push, stop, big.
Yeah. Going a tag team. He had a tag team match on the show. I didn't really expect him to come out after the match.
He doesn't have this long experience as a main event guy. You know, Shiozaki. It's been doing this a lot longer, you know? And I'm sure that the two years from now that Shiozaki against Kiyomiya on top championship match will be your main event type thing.
I agree. I feel like Keno might be in that picture too.
Keno? Yeah. But he's a junior heavyweight though.
But he had a nice match with Masakatsu Funaki, who's
a lot taller. Beating Funaki's big deal.
In
Budokan.
Yeah,
I think so too. It's kind of like beating Minoru Suzuki, right?
Sure, it has to be. Who else? I mean, or Sakuraba or something on your first.
Yeah, right.
So I thought that the show, what was very interesting about the show was how it felt like a re-debut, at least to me, because everything looked different, fresh look, new and old faces, but it definitely felt like, okay, this is not New Japan. It didn't feel like New Japan at all. It felt more sporty, maybe. It felt like it was really catering to the Showa era, Heisei era fans.
You're talking about today's New Japan. No,
today's New Japan. New Japan,
but it was more like a major league Japanese company.
Mm-hmm. It really felt major league.
Yeah, because you had a lot of legends, you know, like Sakura, Aba, you know, Kazuki Fujita, the Kendo Kashin, the, you know, like all those believable former MMA guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what's good thing is though, they, you know, put those legends with today's pro wrestling knows wrestlers and have competitive matches.
And hopefully in the end, the younger wrestlers
guy will come out. Yeah, yeah.
And the old ones.
So it's going to be a very, we will remember this pro wrestling knows Budokan night as something really symbolic.
I really think you know, so.
And yeah, Keiji Muto, yes, won the title. It's a big news, and people thought, well, yeah, of course it's good news. But I think in hindsight that it would be remembered as revival of pro wrestling Noah, huh?
Some kind of new stage for sure.
And yeah, I think so too.
And they have a new logo too.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed that too.
It kind of looks like a football logo, yeah. U.S. football.
Ah, okay.
Or arena football.
They had not so popular second logo, you know?
So that's the third logo in the past. So
yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, and this
Shiozaki's still carrying emerald green Mitsuharu Misawa image color, which is good.
Do many younger fans remember, are they still, is there still a lot of care towards Misawa? Or because we talk sometimes about the New Japan universe, and I don't feel like they're interested in that era of Misawa or older Noah. But what would you say the
New Japan world, New Japan world, or New Japan fans? I don't think they ever really watched it. You know,
mm-hmm.
see, we're talking about the like two or three different generations of Japanese wrestling fans. The 90s wrestling fans had New Japan follower and strong, you know, Misawa, you know, four pillar guys era that all migrated into after Baba died, you know, they created the pro wrestling Noah, the fans migrated too. But today's New Japan fans, they've been watching and they've been following New Japan pro wrestling only about 5 years, maybe 10 year tops. Mm. So 90s wrestling is ancient to them. Therefore, today's New Japan fans, I call it New Japan world, I don't think they really followed Keiji Muto in his prime. You know?
So then it seems to be win-win for everybody because the New Japan New Japan world fans keep getting great New Japan product, and a lot of older fans.
Yeah, because they're creating new stars, mm-hmm. for new fan base,
and
which
I hope,
is really important.
I hope this is a good way for Noah to create or establish their new stars in a year or two.
Yeah, I think there's a big possibility, and also Noah, along with DDT, okay, they are under the very huge cap, you know, umbrella capital of media, you know, yeah, outlet.
A cyber agent, yeah.
Yeah, cyber agent is like your parent company. They got money, you know, and also they are not television, but they are really in like the internet, that the live stream,
forward thinking.
Yeah, so it's not a DVD or TV or satellite TV or nothing like that. It's like today's audience will be watching your wrestling from your iPod or your laptop or even your iPhone. And those are the audience they're looking at.
And Cyber Agent also is in charge of Abima TV, the digital TV channel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is really more geared at a younger audience than something like TV Asahi.
Right, you know, and pretty soon that we all have the whole new population that grew up watching Ameba TV.
And yeah, maybe we'll watch the Olympics on it too.
I have it on my phone, but I never use it. They got like a couple thousand shows, you know, available. So you have to look for it, you know?
So that's actually, I don't use it. And I don't think I've ever used it until this weekend because they had to watch it. It was free. They aired it in Japanese for free. If you wanted it in English, you had to pay through Fight TV.
Oh, okay. Right.
So
over here, Ameba TV, and some people even watched, see in Japan, some people do have Fight TV because they want to watch AEW and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. but yeah. And English commentary was available too this time.
That's right. Mark Pickering and
Yep.
Stewart, I forget his last name, but they're on the Quintet team too. They do.
Yeah. Very professional.
Very good. Martial arts guys. So, okay. Keiji Muto week. He's buzzing really right now, both in this English speaking sphere. And of course in Japan, I saw him on the cover of a weekly pro wrestling today.
Yeah.
Nice shot.
And also, this might, you know, this Keiji Muto's last reign as or the Major League Championship this might bring back some of the fans who left wrestling during this dark age of millennium era. You know,
mm-hmm. The lapsed fans.
Yeah.
And so now he's a kind of Grand Slam champion. Is that right?
Right. Grand Slam champion, meaning that the New Japan's IWGP Championship and All Japan Pro Wrestling's Triple Crown. Triple Crown's International Heavyweight and Pacific Wrestling Federation Heavyweight and UN, United National Heavyweight Championship. Three existing belts made it into one belt. It happened back in 1990 between Jumbo Tsura and Stan Hansen. So they combined all existing three belts into one major belt, Triple Crown. So Muto won that. So IWGP, Triple Crown, now GHC. Yeah, three major titles. I don't know how many people have done that. Kensuke Sasaki have done that. But,
And NWA, too. NWA title? Or WCW? Keiji Muto? Didn't he win that G1 in 93? 92?
Yeah, that was... Masa Chono won that one, though.
Oh, okay, that was the... Okay, I'm mixing.
Yeah, but yes, he did win the NWA title from somebody like Barry Windham.
So around there, maybe it's a couple of years or like a 90 or 89. I'm not sure.
Right. You know what? I must be the old fashioned guy that those WCW version of NWA is hard to remember, you know?
Hey, it's for me too, because it was unclear. Unclear.
For a while, WCW heavyweight title and NWA world title, they treated as a one. Then after a while, they split into two different titles. Then they kind of dropped it, you know?
They did that quite a bit. And, you know, I don't think many people know, but I recently saw the Gaia company post an old Gaia match for the WCW Women's Cruiserweight.
Cruiserweight title. Right.
Which I don't think was defended in America.
Still in Japan.
I don't think it was ever even talked about or shown on television or anything. I didn't know much about it at all.
I think they created the Women's Cruiserweight title for WCW Worldwide TV show.
Oh, was there a plan?
WCW Worldwide, nobody watched?
Oh, I watched it all the time.
Oh, did you?
I watched that, and there was a show called Prime, WCW Prime. It was a half-hour show that would show on one of the sports networks. They would show it five days a week, like 30 minutes, just squash matches, but for the lower-tier guys.
CNN, that's a CNN center stage, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Or at Disney, wherever they were doing in the 90s, a Disney studio.
Right. Yeah, I remember that one too. Yeah.
But so
they were taping like 5-6 weeks worth of TV.
Yeah. Or just
all day long.
Yeah. And it had content for, but it wasn't great wrestling or anything. You might have one tag match between, I don't know, Public Enemy or Harlem Heat. They were the big, that was our High Voltage. If you remember High Voltage.
Yeah. I remember all those. Yeah.
A lot of characters like that. But so worldwide, that title, WCW Women's Cruiserweight title, was introduced for that show. Was that the plan?
I guess.
Supposedly, yeah. I'll have to do some more research on that. We can get back to that. But let's get back to Keiji Muto.
Japan, you know, some of the details, you know, is very interesting in Japan, the Japanese independent scene too, that you probably don't know. There's a Missouri heavyweight, you know, Missouri Heavyweight Championship in Japan. There's a Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight title in Japan. There's a you know, U.S. heavyweight championship. You know, the design is like, you know, that the red leather with American map on it, like your the chic or, you know, mm-hmm. that certain design belt.
Yeah, the North one with Carolina. It has the shape of the country on the belt.
Yeah, itself. Right. Yeah, that all those belts are defended in Japan now. Seriously, oh in the independent scene. But nobody pays attention. But it's okay. We are talking about Keiji Muto's his legacy. And if we have like younger listeners, serious listeners out there, that by learning, you know, that Muto's career and his legacy, that we'll have a pretty good picture of that wrestling scene from mid-80s into 90s, 90s into, you know, 10, 20, and the 2000, then now. You know,
yeah, and he seemed to kind of change with each decade that passed too. He's like a Terry Funk or Chris Jericho who kind of changed.
Pretty much, yeah. Terry Funk, Flair too.
Flair, sure.
Yeah, super long hair Flair to a short hair Flair to a, you know, WCW version Flair to WWE version of Flair. Yeah, Keiji Muto is very similar. You know.
Yeah. Plus, he used a different wrestling moves too. He'd introduce new ideas when he was older. We can get to that later, like when he was in All Japan, right, the Shining Wizard and such.
Actually, it's very important for a superstar to come up with a new finish about like every 10 years or so. Did you know that?
I feel that like it makes sense, but I didn't know that it was a real thing.
Perfect example is Chris Jericho's
Judas effect.
Yeah. Now, when he does that, you know it's the end of the match.
That's right. Because yeah, they protect it.
Yeah, yeah. So the finish is like that, you know. Did you know that Antonio Inoki didn't use Enzigiri until he was like 40, you know, 35?
No. What did he use the flying knee drop before that?
Octopus?
Or Cobra Twist, yeah.
Or German suplex for the special matches.
For Carl Gotch, the first New Japan. Kind of owed to him.
One against Fujinami or one against Choshu. One against like ancient strong Kobayashi matches. Very important periodically. Very important single matches. Inoki used German suplex as his finish. Yeah, of course, learned from Carl Gotch. Yeah. So, that's why they call it German suplex in Japan.
And I sometimes hear on Japanese commentary, though, Russian suplex.
Russian?
Yeah. Yeah, they used to say that for Hase Zuranage kind of throw.
Ah, it came from Sambo wrestling. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, yeah. I was in preparation for our show today. I was watching a specific match with Keiji Muto and Hase and Kensuke Sasaki and Masahiro Chono from 1990. It was a tag team where I think Chono and Muto lost the tag team titles to Sasaki and Hase. Do you happen to remember
that? That was at the Budokan?
Yeah. Or
yeah,
it was in Tokyo.
It
was the Tokyo one. And it was a really, really hotly contested match. I was wondering if you had any memories of that, actually.
Yeah, I do.
But we'll get to that. Let's rewind.
Right. Muto Chono against Hase and Kensuke, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a really good one.
Or that era. That era is when all of those wrestlers were really peaking.
Right. Muto was born 1962. You know? Then he just turned, you know, December of 1962. So he just turned 58. He's been wrestling, 37 years? Mm-hmm. Debut 1984 though. That's quite a long time, huh?
It's older than me, just about.
yeah. Did you know that the debut match was against Chono?
As Young Lions.
Yeah, both rookie. Chono's debut match and Muto's debut match. Two rookie went against each other.
They have a very deep story between those two throughout the years.
Yeah, actually, add Hashimoto too. Three of them. Mm-hmm. Three Musketeer.
Who else was a part of that class, though? We had the Three Musketeers and Masakazu Funaki too?
Yeah, and Akira Nogami.
So it's a pretty unique
five
set.
Five of them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. That class was big. And the 1 year before that, Jushin Thunder Liger, the Sano, and a couple more guys that are like huge.
So before he debuted as a wrestler, he was kind of a judo ace.
Yeah, yeah, the third national, third place in national, and also he right after the high school, he went to judo chiropractic college. They got the license.
Wow. So he's kind of a medicine man, you could say.
Yeah, not quite medical school, but the chiropractic school, it's a little bit different from like your medical, the doctor. But he went 3 years school for that. And then they got the piece of paper. Yes. But he wanted to be a wrestler.
Mm-hmm. And then by 21, he was at the dojo trying out.
Yeah, by 20 or so. Yeah, 21. Yeah.
I heard he almost quit. Is that true?
Yeah, like a first weekend.
First week, he's too hard.
Yeah, first weekend. Yeah, and then it's okay. He was gonna pull Chono and Hashimoto too. Like, let's quit together. Oh God,
It's funny. We were just talking, comparing him to Ric Flair. It was the same situation with Ric Flair too, wasn't it?
Him and Ken Patera.
And Vern Gagne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vern Gagne school and the coach was Billy Robinson.
Oh yeah.
And there was a people like in Billy Robinson class. You have Ric Flair, you have Ken Patera, you had Sergeant Slaughter, you have Playboy Buddy Rose, and a lot of guys, right? Mm-hmm. And Flair wasn't all that special then. Pretty special because he played football for University of Minnesota, but nobody thought he was gonna be your Ric Flair. I mean, decades later.
Right? Pretty amazing.
But the Muto was special. Muto, Chono, and Hashimoto, Three Musketeers especially, was very, very special. There's a few reasons for it. They came into dojo right after the big group left the company. Two big groups, Riki Choshu and his 15 guys, formed Japan Pro Wrestling and moved to All Japan.
That was the first set.
First set. Yeah.
Exodus.
Riki Choshu, the Kuniaki Kobayashi, the Animal Hamaguchi, the Killer Khan, the, Yoshiaki Yatsuda, all those guys migrated, they quit together, and Riki Choshu formed a new company called Japan Pro Wrestling and signed the contract to All Japan and started working with Giant Baba's All Japan, 85. So, skeleton, right? And also, that was the year Akira Maeda's very first incarnation of UWF was formed. They left New Japan, so the dojo was empty.
It went
when Muto and Hashimoto and Chono signed, and it's like they were practicing in empty ring almost. So you would think it's not very good time, right? Like a down period of New Japan, right? That's when I thought Muto was very special. He thought, all those guys are gone. It will be on TV next week. Great. He was like that.
So he had his first match with Chono, 84.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he went overseas soon after. When did he go overseas?
85.
So yes.
One year later.
So only 1 year later, and he was in the South US. He was in Florida, and Alabama.
The reason he was sent, just like I said, Riki Choshu and his 15 guys left, right? And Akira Maeda, Takada, and his, that UWF group left, 10 guys left. So it's like New Japan lost about 25 guys in 1 year. And they needed golden rookie. And they thought when Muto, Hashimoto, Chono came in, it's like, whoa, we got three great rookies here. They didn't look at Funaki as special back then because, why? Masakatsu Funaki was only 15 then.
Wow.
He quit high school in the middle of his 10th grade and joined New Japan, and he debuted, before his 16th birthday. So he was a kid then. But Muto, Chono, and Hashimoto were very promising golden rookie. They picked Muto to be the next star, so he was sent to Florida in 1985 on his own. And in Florida, Hiro Matsuda was waiting for him, to make him into a star, you know, grow your hair long. And they made him Black Ninja. That's kind of cliche, but the ring name is okay. It's okay at the time because he was still a rookie, but he needed to be on his own. And oh, also they had the Kendo Nagasaki as baby, you know, Muto's babysitter. They spent the whole year in Florida and a little bit in Puerto Rico. And he came back as a space long off. Yeah. Yeah. At the end of 86. Yeah. So he, year later in 1986, 87, the Muto came back from Florida 1 year later, and he was put in the main event cluster with people like Inoki, Fujinami, Kengo Kimura, and all that. Yeah.
How did people react to him when he came back?
Kind of not great, because he didn't really earn it, sort of.
I see.
Yeah, and then plus that his return match, that the very first match was a single match against Fujinami. Then Fujinami was in his prime and showed some little bit of greenness in there, you know. But he was already in the main event group. And Chono and Hashimoto, one by one, they all left and went to Europe, went to Canada. And then they, you know, you have to be gone, right, for like a year or so. Then come back as somebody new. New hairdo, new costume, new finish, even new ring name. So that's the system.
Reverse export.
Yeah, sort of. And also it's kind of good to be gone from TV for the whole year. And then when you come back, people anticipate this guy must be really good now. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. It's like Evil in New Japan when he went to ROH and came back as
All of them.
All of them. Oh, yeah, sure.
Kazuchika
Okada. Naito. Nakamura.
Naito, Okada, or Tanahashi and Shinsuke Nakamura 15 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it did that with Giant Baba. They did that with Antonio Inoki. They did that with Jumbo Tsuru, Tenryu, Fujinami, everybody.
That's the system.
Yeah, for the past 60 years. Yeah.
I'm interested. That's the
interesting part. Yeah.
So,
everybody.
So Muto ended up going back to the States shortly after that, though.
There's another reason. And he came back and he was in the main event group already, but not as established. But in spring of 1987, spring of 1986, Maeda, the Takada, the Fujiwara, Yamazaki, the six UWF guys came back to New Japan and joined New Japan as a faction, UWF. So you got the veteran, you know, like a 6-7 veterans, you know, made a comeback to New Japan, like home. Then spring of 1987, all those Riki Choshu's 10 guys came back to New Japan. It's like, oh my God, it's like a way loaded, you know? So the Sakaguchi, the then booker, Seiji Sakaguchi, decided to send Muto back to the States for the second time. Go over there as long as you want, you know, until you're ready, until we are ready to use you. Does that make sense?
And he also hit Puerto Rico one more time around this time too, right?
It started from, 87, Muto was sent to Puerto Rico first. And he was tag teaming with people like Kendo Narasaki and Mr. Pogo. And in 87, Puerto Rico was really hot too, you know? You had Brody then there, you know? And so he spent months there in Puerto Rico. Then he was booked to World Class, Dallas.
With the Gary Hart.
Yeah, yeah. Then from Dallas, he was booked to Jim Crockett's NWA in 89.
And it was around this time we got the first inklings of the Great Muta character.
Yeah. To be exact, July of 1989, he became the Great Muta.
Oh, his birthday.
What was funny is though, Muto, right? His real name, M-U-T-O. Some people put an H, but you don't need H on it, you know. But the Muto, they read it like they pronounce it like Muta. So therefore, he became Muta.
Easier for fans to say in America.
I guess, yeah, yeah.
I think that was the idea.
And also, he was introduced as son of the great Kabuki.
Mm-hmm. Who had been working in Texas for a while at that point.
Oh, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, mm-hmm. all over the place.
And at that point, he was established in world class at Fritz von Erich's company. And,
of course.
And they...
Kabuki wasn't even there, though, already. I mean, he was back in Japan, with All Japan.
Oh, they just sold it like that on the television.
Yeah, and also same manager, Gary Hart.
Gary Hart, did he have a big part in creating that character?
I think so.
Or how much of it was Keiji Muto himself?
Well, what he did in the ring is all Muto, you know, but the green mist, you know, like a mist blowing thing, or your Kabuki hat, the whole costume, like a very cliche, stereotypical Oriental look. It all came from American side. Yeah. I mean, it's really funny that, you know, not anymore. It's not like that anymore. But like in 70s and 80s, even way into 90s, when the Japanese wrestler worked for an American company, they expect you to be so Japanese, huh?
Stereotypes, yeah.
Very much so, yeah. All of them, you know. That's why they have this funny knee tights, like, you know, Masa Saito's trademark, you know, like a Japan on it, you know, on the side. The knee tights, salt throwing, very sneaky, yeah. Other things, yeah.
Yeah, kind of out of date by the 80s. It was kind of always out of date.
But they had the Nazi character all the way into 70s. Then you had the, you know, character Russians for the Cold War era into a superpower era. You always had the Russian wrestlers. You always had the Arabs, you know, the sheiks, the Iron Sheik, and So those stereotypes always worked in wrestling. And Great Muta was one last one, you know?
He was kind of the last one, but he was also the first kind of wrestler who came over and had his own identity and seemed to be very, very popular with the U.S. crowd at the time, especially in NWA, WCW. He was right.
Oh, yeah, won over fans because of what he did in the ring, so flashy.
It was very new and fresh and cool for people at the time. There was nobody like him at the time to compare him to either. So with him and Sting, WCW, NWA had a very fresh look, colorful.
Okay,
so Great Muta's in NWA, WCW. He does go back to New Japan in 90. Keiji Muto.
Upon his return, he was already a big, huge star because all the Starcade thing, you know, the biggest run was 1989 December Starcade, you know, round robin small tournament. Ric Flair, Sting, Lex Luger, and Great Muta. Four guys wrestling each other, I mean, one another, right, in one night. And that was huge news that during the summer, the same year, summer, Great Muta challenging Ric Flair for NWA title over and over and over. It was on all the news, the sports, Tokyo Sports, that the other, you know, newsstand, sports paper, tabloid in Japan that was printed. We did a lot of features in, you know, our wrestling magazine. What's Muto doing in America, and his hair's growing, and he's on top, you know, top NWA, WCW, and obviously he's a main eventing, you know, single match against Sting, single match against Ric Flair, single match against people like Lex Luger and all that. They just, wow, Muta became, Keiji Muto, I should say, Muto became such huge star in America, and people were waiting for him to come back.
He must have really found something in the character, because from that character, you could see every body movement had kind of evolved from when he had gone through the Great Muta phase. This was by 1990, he had hit his full maturity, I think, as a wrestler. And Kono and Hashimoto, especially the Three Musketeers, 1990, when he returned, I mean, that was if you're going to go and watch any of the matches, that's the prime time to watch.
And also people were ready to have them as your main guys. You know, Inoki, you know, left the company to be the politician. And Ricky Choshu and Fujinami still there, but they're like senior guys in mid-40s, you know. And they people needed fresh main event young superstars. Then there's going to be a... Then you had the G1 climax, you know, era starts. That will establish you as some real, believable, legitimate superstar. See, single round robin tournament in Japan has been always been important because single match is important, right?
So in 1991, the singles tournament, we had G1 for the first time.
Right. But it was like, it was Chono's night, you know, instead of Muto's, you know.
Mr. G1 himself.
They established Chono as the new star, yeah.
But it, around that time, he didn't seem to lose any steam. People were pretty
very
wild
special.
For him.
Yeah, and then during the very first year, G1 climax, Keiji Muto pinned Fujinami 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring at the Sumo Palace, which established you as right. Now he's above Fujinami even, you know, kind of thing.
And by that time, he started using the Dragon Screw Leg Whip around that time too. Is that right?
Was from Takada match on.
I got it. So we have three more years to go. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, because did we talk about the people's finish? You know, introducing new finish is a very important thing.
Oh, no, we did. We were talking about that before. So let's talk about that. This has been part of Muto's career too.
When he debuted in, you know, October of 1984, debut match against Masa Chono, he was already using moonsault as a finish, debuting rookie. You know, very first match he beat Chono. I mean, debut match though, he used moonsault to beat Masa Chono 1-2-3. I mean, he was already using his original move as a finish. That tells you how special he was, you know. And you talked about the dragon screw, you know, screw leg sweep into figure four leg lock thing. Mm-hmm. He created that for the match against Nobuhiko Takada, New Japan against UWFI, Tokyo Dome match.
The first
one. Back then, was that a 94 or 95?
October 95.
Okay. It was established superstar IWGP champion, Keiji Muto against UWFI's superstar Takada. It was a promotion against promotion that UWF International was going to change wrestling, right? The whole UWF concept was to change your professional wrestling into legitimate contest. Well, it didn't, but the whole theme was, remember?
It was the seed.
Tokyo Dome, yes, the whole theme was. At the Tokyo Dome, most people thought Takada was going to beat Muto. It was interesting.
Why was that?
Well, because he was portrayed, you know, Takada at the time, you know, 93, 94, he was the best. You know, he beat everybody, and he also got the championship belt from, you know, Luthes, you know, legitimate world heavyweight, pro wrestling world heavyweight title. He was beating Russian. He was beating, Takada was beating then Super Vader, you know, who they signed away from New Japan and brought in. Or
Gary Albright.
Takada knocking out former sumo wrestling Yokozuna champion Kitao, knocked him out at the Budokan. And just those were his peak years, you know. But what people didn't realize was that the only reason that the Tokyo Dome show New Japan against UWFI happened was that UWF was losing business, you know. Declining, you know,
just in general. It because of the Yoji Anjo situation?
That, and also it was like it had, you know, the Yoji Anjo situation, meaning that he's going to, he went to what the Hickson Gracie's dojo and losing it, and UWF being supposedly being legitimate, all shoot, and you are MMA fighter before there was such term MMA, and supposedly you are the best, right? And eventually they had to do Hickson Gracie against Takada, you know. Then you and I know that the Takada lost to Hickson Gracie. He completely lost it, you know. And that was the end of UWF era.
And you have to talk about that another show.
But if you lived in 1995, you lived in Tokyo, that you would think it's definitely Takada who's going to go on top. But instead, it was New Japan show, you know, that Muto really came up with creative idea that I asked Muto, you know, after the match, or like I did a couple different interviews because I wanted to know. See, Dragon Screw leg sweep isn't anything new. That was Fujinami's move in 70s and 80s, you know. And figure four leg lock is one of the oldest moves in wrestling, you know, not just Buddy Rogers or the Dick Byer Destroyer, but I mean, it's a really, really old move, isn't it? Ric Flair, Nick Bockwinkel, you know?
Buddy Rogers.
Yeah, yeah.
Greg Valentine. So,
yeah, everybody. Not everybody, but the very believable submission, right?
Common move.
Common move. But it looks like the end of the night. You know? Yeah. Or the when you think about the Ric Flair, the entire match, 30-minute match, revolves around how you got to go into the figure four. You know, you'll be working on your body parts, legs, knee drops, kicking the legs, you know, and all kinds of moves. Then you eventually go into your figure four, you know. And Muto came up with the idea that Takada will be kicking, right? So it's like, I'm going to catch Takada's and hold it and make it into a leg sweep and do that a few times and see how people pops. And it was like, he was saying that Muto was saying that he was being chef. There's a like a food, you know, that hasn't cooked, you know, I'm going to use this and cut it. I'm going to use this, cut it and fry it. And then, you know, make good, I mean, good tasting meal that leg sweep, certain things, leg sweep, certain things, leg sweep, then into figure four. And it worked like to perfection. Then Muto smiled. It's like, look what I just did. And it was believable, you know? And Takada came out like sore loser, you know? He did that time. And people didn't realize he was much taller than Takada too. He's like, they look, you know, they face each other in the middle of the ring, right?
He's quite a big guy, Keiji Muto.
Yeah, real big guy. Yeah, but when you are just watching UWFI tapes, Takada comes off like really tall. Your main guy, the single match guy who comes out at the end of the night, main event guy, and who's also a champion, and he acts like champion, walks like champion, and he carries himself like champion, and he looks like a big guy. But when you face each other in the middle of the ring, Takada and Muto was clearly like 2-3 inches taller, you know? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
He maybe has like a Tom Cruise aura.
Yeah.
Takada.
Yeah.
Don't you think so? Because Tom Cruise is quite, he's short.
Right.
He's
short. People don't know how short Tom Cruise really is, huh?
No, because I mean, we know him for his movies and he's so big and over the top. We just, in our mind, he's big.
He's a big guy.
Because of what he's done. And how he's been presented. I think Takada has a
Sly Stallone too. Sylvester Stallone. He's not tall at all, you know? Same thing. But anyhow, that was the night when Muto beat Takada, Muto became even bigger star because of it.
He was really the New Japan's captain. He was the face of that company in the 90s. Even Hashimoto and Chono of the Three Musketeers, it was Keiji Muto's. He was the
guy. Yeah, because he was all around. See, Hashimoto is more of like a fighter. You know, he chops and kicks and cries and a lot of emotions and less moves. The brainbuster and DDT, that's about it, right? Just emotional. I mean,
passion.
People like him. Yeah, passion. Whereas Masachono is so cool. I mean, he doesn't do much flashy moves, but he works body parts and being like a cool guy, you know?
And he has a great voice. His voice is cool.
And his finish STF, step over toe hold with face lock, was given to him by Lou Thesz. So people believed him, you know?
He was the last disciple of Thesz.
Yeah, and winning G1 every summer, that made him star too, you know? So they took New Japan, actually Booker, Ricky Choshu, took different method of promoting these three guys. And Keiji Muto was clearly above those two, right? And natural ability. Yeah. But we skipped 91, 92, and 93 though.
Yeah, we can come back to that.
It was like, yeah, Keiji Muto has always been, but he had bad knee from the day one, though.
From the moonsaults, yeah?
From judo, I believe.
Oh, so he was coming into the business with some, not 100%. The knees were...
Right, because he already had bad knee when he was in Florida in 86.
Hmm.
That's why he walks. Do you see how he walks?
He walks a very distinct way, kind of lopsided.
Yeah, because his knee can always give, you know?
But yeah. That kind of informs how he wrestles, because if you really watch him these days, he's great at not doing anything, but getting lots of story and action out of just kind of doing a slow somersault roll and walking around his opponent. He's really clever.
And he created a short dropkick, you know, basement dropkick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I asked him too. It's like he said he couldn't jump that high anymore. So therefore, your dropkick will be people's knees, you know?
It works for him.
But
and it
made
works
it look like he means to do it, you know? He can still do it though, but like he's not going to waste any of his energy or, you know, muscle tissue or anything like that. You know, he's so scientific that when he does it right timing and, you know, the most effective way and all that things, you know. He's like an all-around great worker that he's been working around his bad knees all these years. Yeah.
Always changing around it too.
Right. So you had the moonsault era and the leg sweep, dragon screw into figure four leg lock era. Then he went to America and came back and he created another finish, Shining Wizard.
Oh, that's skipping ahead a little bit. We'll do that in our next episode. That's 2001, yeah. January 28th, 2001, I remember, with a Taiokea match.
Yeah.
But we'll get back to that. So around 91, 92, 93 was also a really hot time for Muta / Muto.
And New Japan in general, yeah.
New Japan, absolutely. We were just talking about Hulk Hogan last week. There was the big 93 Hogan and Great Muta match. That says a lot about...
Yeah, New Japan. See, when New Japan and Masa Saito, Riki Choshu booked Hulk Hogan back to Japan, the first time in 7 years or so, who would you have him... I mean, who would you have him wrestle? Hulk Hogan has to have single match, right? Mm-hmm. He has to be in like a baseball stadium type of big show. And who would you have? I mean, Riki Choshu, Hulk Hogan wouldn't do it. Masa Saito, Hulk Hogan wouldn't do it. You know, and then who can you have? Then they were like from the day one, like, when we have Hulk Hogan, we'll have Muto have single match. And what was interesting, I'm not sure if I can say this, but the first thing Hulk Hogan asked New Japan office, Masa Saito, to be exact, was that send me the video of Keiji Muto. I'll study it.
Oh, wow.
You know, a couple of VHS tapes of Keiji Muto's single match.
Mm-hmm.
Not the clips, but I have to watch the whole thing. And Hulk Hogan studied Keiji Muto's single match at home, then came over. That's how serious, you know, Hulk Hogan is about his work in Japan.
That says a lot. He went in always completely prepared, especially at that match too with Muta. He breaks into a cross arm breaker at the beginning of the match, you could hear the crowd go, wow. Didn't expect any of that.
Lock up, the side headlock into hammerlock, hammerlock into takedown, takedown into another, you know, arm. Just, he wrestled, right?
Yeah, who is this guy?
Yeah.
But
how Kogan works like that in Japan?
It's very, knowing that part of his career, that dimension of his career, it really makes you think about him a little bit differently. You have to factor all that in.
Yeah, right. So it's how Kogan isn't just you want the three punch to a big boot to a leg drop. That's all he does. That's what he does in WWE, you know. But even in AWA, you know, we skip AWA, seem to skip AWA a lot. But the 82 and 83, Hulk Hogan spent half the year in Japan, half the year in AWA. In AWA, he was wrestling more, you know. He had a single match against people like Nick Bockwinkel, like 30-minute single match, wrestling match, which was quite different from what he would be doing with WWE years later. Yeah.
He had talent. So, but.
And AWA was also very first, Hulk Hogan's very first babyface run in America. So he rehearsed all that before WWE.
Huge part of the,
I think so. His career. I think so. Yeah.
And if you haven't listened to our episode on Hulk Hogan, that's the one from before. You can listen to that on the Patreon.
What people don't remember is that in 83 in the AWA, Hulk Hogan was already saying, "How can the 24-inch Python and what you gonna do?" And you know, I didn't realize. And let me tell you something, Mean Gene Oakland, then AWA announcer, standing right next to him. In AWA, you had Jesse Ventura, the Ken Patera, the Adrian Adonis, the you know, later on Killer B, Jim Brunzel. WWE stole half the crowd from AWA, you know, all the way down to people like Mad Dog Vachon and Crusher, you know, older guys. They signed away everybody.
They cleared them out.
So that was interesting. Then Bobby Heenan, of course.
Of course. At Oakland.
Gene Oakland. Yeah. Oh, Rick Martel, Tito Santana. A lot of them. Yeah. But anyway, we got to go back to Keiji Muto. He, after two long trips to America, 85, 86 Florida trip, 87, 88, 89, you know, Puerto Rico, Dallas, and NWA Crockett into WCW. He had a long run in America, right? And
can I tell you something? I want to share my opinion with you because I want to hear what you think of this. Yeah. I don't know if it's, I really, because of this time that Keiji Muto spent in America, I mean, it really, to me, it defines what I see when I see him now. I really view him more of as an American style wrestler.
Yeah,
way more so than, for example, Shinya Hashimoto is a really Japanese wrestler, I think.
Oh God, with karate chops? Mm-hmm. Of course.
Or Tenryu is a really Japanese wrestler.
Oh, the backhand Tenryu chops? Oh my gosh.
He's a former sumo too. So there's a lot of, it's a different spirit, but with Muto, it's different. It signifies.
And also, yeah, I completely agree with that because see Hashimoto's good matches are always against another Japanese guy. Keiji Muto can work against Japanese and also work against Americans and have equally good matches.
Yeah. Very different matches.
Yeah. Doesn't pick opponent. He will always be good worker, you know?
Yeah. Matches with Vader or Bam Bam Bigelow, big monsters around that time, or
yeah, like people like Scott Norton. What can you do? Sting. With it?
It really Sting, brings the best out of Sting, or just even Lex Luger.
Yeah, or against Japanese, like you know Muto against Chono, Muto against Hashimoto, Muto against Kensuke Sasaki, Muto against Hiroshi Hase, Muto against Chono, Muto against Fujinami. At the end, Muto against Antonio Inoki at the Fukuoka Dome, you know?
Ah. He can improv with anybody, it seems like.
I think so. In 1997, can you imagine carrying Inoki into a decent match? You know?
You mentioned Hase, and around 92, 93, there was a match where it was a really bloody match those two had. And it was one of those matches. Great Muta and Hiroshi Hase. And
yeah, actually, it was he's even genius as Keiji Muto was, he struggled a little bit upon his return because he didn't want to do Great Muta gimmick in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to have just regular short trunks, tights, and regular wrestling boots and wrestle as Keiji Muto. But Great Muta part was so popular, and also it was a big push from the office that the merchandise was like, they were selling Great Muta gimmick so much that he had to do two different characters. One night he was Keiji Muto with orange, you know, tights. The another night he has to be a Great Muta. It's kind of crazy, but he was playing two different characters.
He probably should have been paid double.
Well, he was the top pay because he was exceptionally well paid because of the merchandising sales.
So was the Great Muta character, was that viewed as a heel character or as a kind of neutral?
Or more of a fantasy character.
Yeah, just like Undertaker.
Or Alter Ego.
Oh, okay, like Finn Balor with his demon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or, so one, he has to have a reason to become that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's why he... Great Muta had to be a little bit different, that you have to use your foreign object or something, or you have to break rules, or you have to make people bloody, or you have to, I don't know, you got to use your beer bottle or crowbar.
Classic heel technique.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or that's maybe the main difference. That's maybe the main difference between
Muta. Put your foreign object into your ring boots and give people a diving knee drop or something like that, you know? So Muto struggled a little bit to make sure that two different characters are two different style of wrestling. And even Muta struggled a little bit, yeah. Actually, Keiji Muto, plain simple Keiji Muto, always had better match than the character Great Muta, though. You know?
No cheating.
Whereas in America, only Great Muta exists. See, Keiji Muto doesn't exist in America. You know?
Yeah.
He never has regular trunks or white wrestling boots or, you know, short hair or anything like that. So in America, he's always going to be Great Muta.
I think so.
Yeah. But now it's different, yeah. That people are watching with no time lag, that you can watch, you know, current, you know, Keiji Muto on the internet, that there's no delay. So you can watch what he is now. I mean, today, yeah. Same Keiji Muto now.
Mm. And he's, you know, to be honest, he's been pretty regular, semi-regular on TV in America and in UK for...
Right.
Now more like
and
20
also,
years.
WrestleCon every year.
WrestleCon or showing up in, you know, TNA Impact.
Right, that too, yeah.
WCW every now and then. There's always that, he's that mysterious character that
yes.
You talk to your friends about. You go, oh, do you remember that guy who blew the green mist and did the handspring elbow? What was that? He's very much that character, that standout.
Right, right. And what's interesting is that in America, as a Great Muta, he works like Keiji Muto.
It's simple, but it's also kind of a trip to think about it. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, because you're putting a face paint on it and just do a different things and trying to be a different character. But actually, it's the same person doing the same thing.
In around 95 or 96, I think it was, I remember that went to the next level in my eyes when Great Muta had this wild match with Jushin Thunder Liger's alter ego.
Ah, right, right.
In the, I don't, where was that? Was that in,
Budokan? I don't know.
It was very dark, I remember. And it was very dramatic. This was a really, you could almost say this was one of the first cinematic matches that, you know, we see more and more of those now. But at this time, you could view it like that. It's, theatrical.
Was Liger unmasked then?
He was unmasked and he had a lot of face paint on his face.
Underneath, right. See, Liger comes up with a lot of those ideas too. You know, he grew up as a wrestling fan and just has a lot of ideas, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
paint underneath the mask. Oh my gosh, right?
It was pretty unique at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And also, he was another wrestler. Liger was like, everybody knows he's Keiichi Yamada, but it doesn't matter. He's a Liger, you know?
He's always Liger.
Yeah. So even Keiji Muto struggled a little bit when he had to do the two different characters domestically. Yeah.
So how about here? Let's take a break and we'll come back with part two next time.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And that'll be around, we're going to start around 95, 96. We'll start talking about the
Takada. Because there's going to be a NWO Japan era.
That's right. Where
NWO Japan will bring him back to America again in 98 or so, 99. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that was an interesting era too.
Muta and
we're talking about Keiji Muto's 37-year career. So just not possible to talk about this 37-year glorious career in 1 hour. No.
Not even close. He's still making news.
I'm a big fan of Keiji Muto's work. You know, he's just one of the maybe if not ever, and he's the best, you know. I mean, what's the definition of best? But he doesn't disappoint you, you know, and he always surprise you. He'll go beyond your imagination, you know. And yeah, he came beyond your imagination with match against Shiozaki, right?
Mm-hmm. I did 58 not expect
year old,
that.
Yeah, today's 58-year-old Keiji Muto could do that much now, you know, and work so smart.
He works so smart, and he works in every time and every decade, and it changes. He changes kind of naturally, and you can only really notice that by like studying it more and watching more. But there's nobody like him. So next time we'll come to the NWO.
New Japan. Yeah, we covered a little bit of New Japan Muto and Florida Muto. WCW NWA Muto and back to New Japan Muto and the Muto against UWF kind of situation. And now it's moving towards 90s, but we just have to cover everything because he's so special.
Yeah, and he never really went away. You know, he never had a downtime. He never had a retirement time where he just took years off. He was always around. So there's a lot to cover.
Yeah, and then always had bad knees. Mm. Yeah.
And we'll also cover the All Japan period. The
All Japan period, yeah, yeah. Well, let's close with this early 90s, mid-90s, you know, era, and we'll come back with a lot more material next time.
That's right. Okay, so let's wrap it up for tonight. So,
also, if, you know, the listeners out there can send you or email you questions, we'll be answering it.
Sure, yeah. And if you're on the Patreon, you can post on the board or leave us a message there anytime. So
I hope a lot of people will be listening. And because the more you learn about this era, you know, the bigger picture you can have, you know, like you can see it, you know, like, wow, that's how wrestling world worked. Mm. I mean, America and Japan simultaneously, you know, it's not two separate. For me, it's always connected.
It's the full circle, the full story.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Which is why we're going to break this episode into a few parts, because that's what Keiji Muto deserves. We have to do it. So, okay. Where can people find you online, Fumi?
Fumihiko Daio, FUMIHIKODAYO, Fumihiko Daio on Twitter, or you can always find me, Fumi Saito, on Facebook.
All right. That sounds good. Let's wrap it up. We'll come back soon with part two of the Keiji Muto series. So
until Fumi, then.
Yeah, until then. Fumi.
So long from Tokyo.
Write that down.